Hello everyone, before I start, if you'll forgive me, I have a podcast recommendation for you all. It's called the British Food History Podcast. I recommend it to you on the rigorous selection process that I really like it, and maybe you will too. Also, it's a great and rich subject. Most of all, though, I really like the host, who is Dr. Neil Buttery, and he really knows what he's talking about. He's an author, a PhD in the subject, he's got a really good blog as well, actually. But the main thing is he's an absolute and total enthusiast, and that to me is the heart of independent podcasting. He's doing it because he loves his subject, primarily. He's a warm and lovely host, he has lots of really great guests. So Diane Purkis of The People's History of the Civil War fame, she was there for example. She's now done The People's History Approach to Food. There's one just out on medieval food and one I absolutely loved on school meals. How I laughed at that one and cried just a little bit at the memory of the tubes in school liver. So much yuck. Anyway, it's great. Give it a go on your normal podcatcher, the British Food History Podcast with Dr. Neil Buttery.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to Anglo-Saxon England, Series 2, Land, Lordship and People, Episode 6, Life in the Warland. Before I start, can I just remind you very quickly of the resources at thehistoryofengland.co.uk in the Anglo-Saxon England podcast show pages. We spoke last time about how life began to change for some of the English peasantry with the arrival of residential estates from the 8th century onwards. Mainly early on in the form of monasteries and minsters. The need to support a resident lordly household led to the intensification of both lordship and agricultural production. Close to the estate centres, working land held directly of the lords. This became known as inland. Nosy landlords who knew what was going on because they didn't just up sticks and move to the next tribute centre every so often. Landlords who were able to take advantage of circumstances and their rights to lay heavier impositions on the backs of their tenants. This led to the emergence of new social ranks, the bordars, the yibors, peasants who gave up some of the freedoms that churls were used to, in search for employment and security. Peasants whose guiding customs were rooted not in the free peasant warrior, but in private land ownership. So this time, we're going to talk about the others, about the inhabitants of the rest of the country who lived not on these newfangled inland estates, but on traditional farms within the large and multiple estates and shires, mainly owned by itinerant kings or lords. Or indeed, those who did hold land on estates owned by resident religious institutions, but were far enough away from the centre to retain their old rights and customs, or who lived on marginal land which was not conducive to agricultural intensification. We're going to talk about two broad subjects today. Firstly, something about the structure of early farming communities, the nature of landholding and land rights, a smidge about some of the impacts on landscape, and the impacts of the heavy plough, which are indeed heavy. Then we're going to turn to the nature of the inhabitants' relationship with society and the wider Anglo-Saxon state. We'll talk then about the term warland, land held by free churlish families, which brought with it responsibilities to defend and maintain that wider community of the Anglo-Saxon nation. Let us start then with the structure of the first Anglo-Saxon settlements. These would often have conformed to the standard model of a northern European settlement, a kin-based group living in a small settlement surrounded by its own land. Most of the settlements might have had something like four or so families. The largest yet excavated in Essex has about 12 families. Again, holding hands carefully with the responsible and extensive use of qualifiers and weasels, such as possibly, maybe, perhaps and often, two types of early building seem to have been standard. Possibly, maybe, often. All of them built in timber. A large hall-type building and dugout sunken buildings. Within these settlements, you have to guess that small clusters might not just be neighbours, but relatives, mixing and growing with other further-off clusters as women married into new groups and left or arrived in the settlement with their new family. However far down the line you move from the old genocide model to the who-knows-if-there-were-more-than-a-handful-of-invaders-at-all approach, it is in this process of intermarriage and intermixing that Germanic and Britain became one and became English. Evidence survived until quite late of old hide farms, farms of one hide in size, that is to say, shadowy survivals of that original traditional. One at a place called Yatton in Somerset, for example, a hide farm survived until the 18th century. But of course, that's stunningly unusual. Over time, settlements would have tended to become broken up and smaller. At the centre of the home was the word heiortha, the hearth. Chimneys, of course, were a thing of the future, and so people would have sat, ate, drank, and probably slept around the hearth, which was set in the centre of the hall-type building. It was banked up at night and kept alight, and then uncovered in the morning. There remains the shadow also in these old family settlements of the idea of falkland. Falkland is a form of landholding which gradually becomes partially replaced by land given by written charter, which is known as bookland because it's written in a book. Falkland is a shadowy concept and open to all kinds of wrangling by historians, and historians do like to wrangle, but it seems that it's the oldest form of legal landholding within which four generations of a family all shared rights to a piece of land. Those rights, however, those four generations, however, were restricted to great-grandfather, grandfather, father and son, rather than a much wider model of cousins. Over time, though, the model that asserts itself is of land being passed down only to sons, or to daughters if there were no sons, so down to one generation, as it were. Outside of inland, the right to inherit and pass on your land was an absolutely key part of a thane and churl's rights and part of what made them who they were. Partability of land, so splitting up land, in inheritance survives much longer among the peasantry than it did above the nobility, because there were far fewer pressures on them to conform to a strict model of primogeniture. It is easy to think of primogeniture as the obvious and inevitable model, but of course it wasn't. In itself, primogeniture took time to be adopted fully until well after the Normans arrived, even in the higher reaches of society in England. And so, With partability being in force, farm holdings tended to get smaller and smaller as they were split up between children. Taken together then, inheritance culture, the pressures and demands of lordship all tended towards smaller groups exercising rights over land, and those groups exercising their rights over smaller areas of land as well. But the idea of group rights and group responsibility as a concept does not disappear. Nonetheless, the landscape I want you to imagine around 800 or afterwards across the large shires and multiple estates outside the developing inland areas is of a patchwork of pretty small landowners where the ownership of every single bit of land is well known. Rights over land and its assets, whether family or shared, was absolute meat and drink, life and limb to people. All these types of assets essentially were jealously guarded, and they were often very old, prehistoric in some places, like highland and moorland. The nature of land rights was very varied, not simply ownership. There were rights of access, rights to take wood or glean after harvest to graze livestock, rights associated with particular times of year. The brutally binary nature of our modern view of private property is relatively recent in reality. Landscape and environment often moulded the structure of landholding. For example, I always assumed that the reason that boundaries often ended at streams was because they were instantly recognisable and difficult to get across, and so they make a clear edge to a territory. Maybe also because they're defensible. And these factors probably did play their part. But another critical one was that access to water was absolutely essential within a community, not just for people, but also, of course, for livestock. So by creating borders as streams, access to water is, of course, doubled immediately. So environmental factors like that affected the structure of landholding. Then again, we mentioned that the arrival of the mouldboard plough had some consequences too, because it opened up new areas of land to arable farming, and thereby also reduced the amount of pasture available to lowland farms, because that pasture had become arable, as it were. Until in some places, it could be that farms below our Chiltern Scarp, for example, in the lowland, had little land set aside for grazing, and the only grazing might have been the stubble or land in rotation. And at the same time, of course, you now have many more oxen to feed because you've got these whopping great teams of eight to look after, to pull these whopping great ploughs. And so you have, as far as grazing is concerned, a whopping great problem. Without wanting to sound as though I am digressing, one of the glories, then, of the English countryside is the network of pathways, the vast majority of them beautifully marked and mapped on easily accessible Ordnance Survey maps if you happen to be a walker. England may not have the wilderness other countries have, but let me tell you, that does not mean it is anything other than a glorious destination for walkers. And there are a few better ways of seeing its history than just walking it, urban or rural or something in between. I'm wiping my eyes with a hanky as we speak, and here endeth the lesson. The reason for warbling on about pathways is because, of course, they exist, because they were needed for practical purposes way back when. The pathways, effectively then, are on land owned by someone, but with shared rights of access. These days, in modern days, the land might be owned by a farmer, but the first two spits in depth of land are owned by the community in a strip about 6 foot wide. Their origin is in giving communities the access they needed to environmental resources in order for the community to thrive. So in our South Oxfordshire Vale landscape then, there is a very clear group of pathways that lead straight as an arrow up the Chiltern Scarp with a minimum of meandering. Those exist for peasants to move their livestock between lowland and upland, and indeed to access woodland resources. They are often referred to as field and wig, paths leading to wide open spaces, and they are often connected to woodoo, woods, in charters when they're referred to there. Their name suggests wide, grass-covered ways, and they are often old, prehistoric, and we know that because they frequently appear as basically and instantly recognisable landmarks by the community as the basis of boundaries for old charters. Often their name survives as The Drive or Something Drive, or The Drift is quite common as well. So now you can see again the value of what looks at first glance like nothing more than poorer quality land in the hills. Without that land, the effectiveness and productivity of the arable of the vale is greatly reduced because you have to use more of it for livestock or woods. Now, I mentioned wood pasture also, which is a term I'm literally panting to explain. You might well know all of this yourself. But of the many revelations for me of folks like Rackham and Richard Muir, the way that woodland was used in the past is one of the greatest, very differently used to how it is now and how I imagined. I don't know about you, but I have this innate belief that woodland is about tall trees, big things, which when they are big enough, you chop down, cut into planks, and then replant. I learned from Rackham that while this is indeed a thing these days, it is an approach that should not be mentioned without hawking violently, making the sign of the evil eye, falling to your knees in a fit of tears while howling the words, "Modern forestry!" which are, incidentally, to be used as though being tortured to utter them. Imagine Schmeagle, the screams of "Baggins! Shire!" issuing from the dungeons of Barad Dûr, and you'll just about have the mood, because in those days medieval, big trees used for building would have been just one use for trees, and a less common and day-to-day occurrence than most other uses. Often, indeed, those big trees were restricted to hedgerow trees or left to the older, more ancient and impenetrable woods like those on the Wealds of Sussex. Because for the most part, medieval woodsmen used the great qualities of the tree that predominated in England, largely deciduous trees, which is their ability to regenerate. So chop down a deciduous tree from near the base, and it will regenerate from the stem or from suckers to create poles, which you could leave for a number of years, depending on what kind of usage you were looking for and the size of the pole required. So you might need young, thin, whippy poles for baskets or hurdles. Or you might need something a bit more chunky for the vertical posts of hurdles or fences. Or you might be looking for wood for charcoal, or wood to put with wattle to make walls. Or for whatever. The point being that the use of wood was far more diverse and central to medieval life than it is today, given that we've now had the astounding proliferation of materials available to the modern world. All hail be given, above all, to the metallurgist. Always trust a metallurgist. But back in Anglo-Saxon days, you harvest poles when required at the appropriate time, and then they'd regenerate again, and so on, ad infinitum. Cutting near the base is called coppicing, as you probably know, and as you walk round the Chiltern Hills in particular, you will see much evidence of old coppiced trees and hedgerows with wide stools now heavily overgrown, because that's not the way we manage woodland anymore. You might also see gnarled ancient old trees with an unfeasibly thick stem and relatively little top growth. Some such trees are split and hollow with age, but nonetheless still growing. What you might be looking at there is a survival of an ancient pollarded tree. A pollard, as I'm sure you know again, is a tree cut, say, 2 metres above the base and allowed to regrow above the cut, out of reach of grazing animals. They were an elegant solution because they balanced the need for pasture and for wood. The new growth produces wood in the form of spars for hurdles and charcoals, etc., etc., but are high enough to allow grass to grow, the light to get in and grass to grow, and animals to graze it. It is a thing of beauty. It is a thing called wood pasture. Pollarding and coppicing, incidentally, tend to prolong the age of trees as far as 450 to 500 years old for oaks, and Rackham claims that England is unique in its survival of these ancient oaks. I do not know if that's true or not. You'll have to take that up with Oliver, although since he's been dead for a few years, that'll be tricky. But anyway, I am open to comment. As it happens, though, although pollarding was carried out in the Chilterns in quite a few places, the southern Oxfordshire Chilterns favoured the coppicing approach, enclosing the coppices for 7 years to keep the animals off them until the shoots were well established, and then allowing grazing. The world is your lobster, essentially, and the importance, again, of local tradition and of custom is absolutely clear. I might at this point mention, very briefly mention, the ancient and very beautiful art of hedge laying, the creating of a neat and impenetrable living fence by cutting back and training an overgrown hedge. There are multiple styles around the country, and they reflect both local tradition and the kind of agriculture being carried out, and therefore the kind of fence needed. So, the Midland bullock, for example, is a style designed to resist heavy animals pushing against them. The south of England tends to create a double layer. I really have gone off on one now, and you don't come to the history of Anglo-Saxon England to hear about hedge laying, for crying out loud. But look, there is a hedge laying society if this is the sort of thing that floats your boat. So hie thee to the intertubes, hedgelaying.org.uk. The thing is, here is another way in which history, culture and landscape all coexist. So enough of this maudlin nonsense. Where are we? I was describing, before I went off on one, a landscape where land, outside inland, is held within large, multiple estates by a patchwork of individual farms of varying sizes, but generally reducing in size over time, held by individuals with some family rights over parts of the farm. Of smallish settlements of farm buildings, dispersed over a wide area, in groups which you might describe as polyfocal if you were so inclined. Actually, this is quite important, because we tend to think of English villages as having a focus, a centre, often, and indeed usually, near the church. But that all comes much later, and for particular reasons which we'll go into, so hold on to that thought. But for the moment, settlements are just clusters of dwellings which have no particular centre or focus. Right, let us move on then to the nature of the relationship between the Anglo-Saxons and their community and state across normally held land, warland, as it was called. The essential argument here is that holding land and being a member of a wider community brought with it public responsibilities as well. The Anglo-Saxon view of society was one of reciprocal responsibilities. An action like lordship called for a specific response, such as hospitality or protection. And it was participatory. Being part of the community meant you had to take part in maintaining its health. These public obligations were held together by one unifying and binding concept, embedded in the old English word waru. Waru means defence. The rights and obligations existed to defend the land. Defend the land in the broadest sense, to keep it strong and hale, as well as free from its enemies. This is a thoroughly powerful concept, and I feel my patriotic breast swelling as I speak. Warland is a good word, is it not? A very evocative word that smells of earth and leaf mould. Free inhabitants were required to use the wealth of their land to defend the wider state and the community of which they were part. The political nature of the Anglo-Saxon state in which they lived was unusually centralised for Western Europe. Some major landowners were awarded administrative and judicial powers, and they were official and public positions, so they could be revoked by the king at any time and given to someone else. This is absolutely unlike the hereditary offices of the Norman and medieval age, like the Earl or, indeed, for a while, Sheriff. England had developed very differently to France, where after the dissolution of the 8th and 9th century Carolingian Empire, central power was very weak, so local magnates were able to establish autonomous power bases, many of which became almost independent from the central monarchy of France, places like Gascony, Toulouse, Poitou, and so on. None of this happened in England. This centralised power and centralised law had defended and preserved the right of the free peasantry from the local lords, rights which in feudal systems had become reduced or obliterated. In warland, peasants and smaller landowners retained a direct relationship with the king, whatever relationship they had with their immediate lord. The Anglo-Saxons have therefore been described as small statesmen, small freemen charged with public duties. Rights and public duties became associated with land because the wealth of the land was used to protect the health of the state. It does not matter about the social status of the landowner, king or thane or churl, the land still carries public service of the same types. This might sound as though it's the same as feudalism, where the king gives a packet of land called a knight's fee in return for military service, but look, I'm here to tell you why it's different. Firstly, in the English version of feudalism, the land is still all owned by the king, and the recipient of a packet of land, the fee, is merely a land holder, not a land owner. For most churls, their land is inalienable. The king cannot take it away legally. Secondly, the Anglo-Saxon public service is broader than just providing military service. They are responsible for maintaining bridges and fortification works too, and that infrastructure is public, not held by the landowner. In Anglo-Saxon England, the king is, in a sense, just like any other citizen. He holds land, and he holds a lot of it, and many peasants do hold land from the king as tenants. But the king, just like anyone else, owes public service for the land. But equally, there are many churls and thanes who also hold land as of their own right, folkland, not from the king at all. This principle of society is in land held for public good, rather than privately owned land rented out to peasants by private contract. However large your holding, free men owed the same type of public rights and obligations. Obviously, the more wealthy and the larger landowners had heavier obligations and also acquired a higher rank. But the obligations they hold is of the same nature. This is articulated later in a super famous tract called Ye Thunkthu.
And this bit within it is often referred to as the promotion law. And if a churl throve, so that he had fully 5 hides of his own land, church and kitchen, bell house and burgate seat, and special duty in the king's hall, then he was henceforth of thaneright worthy.
I have no doubt we will come back to this, but for now, take these things from this gobbet. There is rank, churl and thane, that is associated with a certain amount of land. The outward display of rank is important. To be a lord, a thane, you needed to have the trappings of one: church, land, kitchen, bell house, burgate seat. To be a thane then carried rights, which meant they also carried public responsibilities. Anyone could be a thane once they achieved those things specified. They could become earlish. It has nothing to do with blood, so there is a healthy degree of social mobility here. Nobility is not just a factor of the family you were born into. Here then is the critical difference with inland tenants. Those unfree inland tenants acquired no public obligations with their land. The land they held was their lord's and was held on a carefully defined set of terms written down, almost a contract. One sign of this was that inland, for example, did not carry the public obligation to pay geld to the king, which I believe we made a meal of last time. So, if you were in warland, if you are a freeman, what are these public obligations then? They are of a different character to the feorum owed to the king or lord that we discussed in the episode about life on the shire. The render of the feorum derived from the personal custom of hospitality and were therefore personal. In addition to and separate to these then were the three common public services which all free men owed to the community, which runs through the laws and charters, all of them. And these are military service, bridge repair and fortification repair. All freemen owed these services. Nonetheless, there were ranks within freemen, and they fall into three broad groups: thanes, yeniats, and churls.
The thane is probably the figure you know most about and have heard of before. He is a landowner, and from the later 9th century, land given by written charter or bookland becomes a clearly articulated and desirable thing. Why, you might ask? Well, it's a lot easier to defend your right and your land if it's clearly defined and written down, rather than relying on a lot of different memories which can be challenged or indeed falsified. So, thanes increasingly expect to hold that land by charter. The thane acquired their name and status originally from the service they performed for the king. Land was then given to them by as a reward for their service. Law codes from Kent as early as the late 7th century tell us that thanes were given a value or wergild that set them apart from peasants or churls. They were earlish, noble, a class that was made worthy to be given the role of ealdorman, an ealdorman being a state regional official, almost like a governor of a shire sort of thing. Just to repeat myself, it was not a closed class and you could become a thane by looking like one. Let me re-quote the promotion law within Yerthankthu, because you know it's important and repetition is the spear of gum-bleeding history. And if a churl throve, so that he had fully 5 hides of his own land, church and kitchen, bell house and burgate seat, and special duty in the king's hall, then was he henceforth of thaneright worthy. However, that did not mean all churls with such qualifications became thanes and claimed the rights. Unless you wanted some political advantage with king or local administration, why bother? In one study in Devon, therefore, the larger farms of some ordinary churls were absolutely indistinguishable from the thanes. They could have claimed that right and status had they so wished. The extent of public obligations due from a thane became increasingly closely defined as time went by and, of course, were heavier than those laid on a churl, as you'd expect. Hence the disincentive to earn yourself the official recognition. They were based on that 5-hide unit. 11th century law codes, such as those of Ethelred, are reasonably clear that a thane with 5 hides needed to provide himself to fight when called out for the defence of the public good, and with him he had to provide all the armour and weapons required. Particular estates might also attract different kinds of military service or repair work. Here is that all-important 11th century Anglo-Saxon document we have grown to love and know, the Rectitudine Singularum Personarum, the estate management document prepared probably at Bath Abbey in the early 11th century. Here we go. The law of the thane is that he should be worthy of his book rights, and that from his land he must do 3 things. Levy a company and be liable for the building and repair of town walls and build bridges. Also, on many estates, more land right is originated at the king's command, such as to maintain the animal hedge for the king's estate and to supply equipment for a defence ship and guard the coast and be a head guard and to perform military watch, to give alms money and church tribute and many other diverse things. The Gobbet makes it clear that the thane expect to have land generated by charter, as we've said, bookland. This might not be all the land they held. They might also hold land of their own by ancient tradition and family right, as mentioned before. Folkland, not given by the king, but his from time immemorial. I must stop saying that. Immemorial. In Rectitudines, you can see those 3 public obligations. Can you not? Right there in front of you for all to see. Levy a company of fighting men for military service. Repair town walls, fortifications, and build bridges. Well, you know, bridges. Then there's other stuff peculiar to this particular estate. Here on this estate, the thane is required to pay ship money. This is money to maintain a public navy to defend the shores of this particular county. Plot spoiler, this will cause something of a storm for Charles I in 1638 when he tries to revive it and make it general to every county. Then there are obligations to give alms, just like the yibor, but unlike the yibor, the thane has to pay the church scot, because he, unlike the yibor, he is free. The Rectitudines also mentions another couple of categories of warland inhabitant. Before going on to Yeniat and Kostetlan, I should say the different statuses are not always so nicely and legally defined. The Rectitudines is very nice for us because of the structure and definition it gives. But it is a bit misleading in a way, because it is just one estate. It is referencing specifically local custom, and there are many sources of status. Just for a couple of examples. One is that the lord and the lady were entitled by law to take 3 servants with their household, crucial to their status when they travelled. Their steward, their children's nurse, and a blacksmith. So there was something special about being a blacksmith. Their role gave them social status. Another source of status was operating a plough. A distinction was often made between those who work and those who plough. Though on inland, that distinction didn't really work because the inland ploughman was usually a slave. But outside of those private manors in warland, the ploughman with a heavy modern plough and a team of 8 was a man of considerable status. He needed to be well off to afford such a thing. And it was also hard, skilled work. And as Abbot Alfric wrote, The ploughman feeds us all. Anyway, back to the Bath Abbey estate and thanes. The category below thane was the yaniat, a term which does not seem to be widely used, but is a kind of lesser thane. They pay public tax, geld. They are free. Their service are at time agricultural, and therefore confer less status than personal service. For example, as quoted in the Rectitudines, provide food for the Lord, reap and mow, cut the animal hedge and maintain snares. But sometimes they were also more general or military. Build and fence the dwellings within an enclosure, and lead newcomers to the enclosure. Hold headguard duties and guard horses. Go on herons, either further or nearer, or to wherever he is sent. In terms of status, however, you will notice the complete absence of any mention of night soil. As far as the yeniat is concerned, night soil is a dirty word. They are not at home to Mr. or indeed Mrs. Night Soil, or anything, any kind of work and service that might dirty the hands. All the service they owe actually falls into the honourable category. In particular, leading newcomers to the enclosure is very much the work of a trusted companion who can be relied on not to pick their nose at an inappropriate moment, to say the right thing at the right time and look the part. So, honourable service. The Rectitudines also mentions a character somewhere in between the yeniat and the peasant called the costetlan, the cottager. Now we are beginning to look a bit more like a peasant since they owe one day's week work and additional work at harvest time. But they may perform thane's service on the thane's behalf, and they pay church scot, so they are, in all probability, still a free man on family. The Rectitudines doesn't mention the name churl, since by the time the Rectitudines was written, churl had become a very general term which might cover a very broad range of statuses. But the costetlan at Bath was probably the equivalent of a churl, not earlish, not thane-right worthy, but nonetheless free and subject to public obligations and geld. So these are the people of Warland then, thane, yeniat, costetlan or churl. You might think the Jews they owe look pretty heavy. I mean, after all, there's agricultural and week work in there for the costetlan, and they owe, of course, their regular tribute, fiorum, to the king or lord. So on the face of it, you might conclude it's all nitpicking, hair-pitting stuff, this stuff about status, and that the difference between the workers of the inland and the obligation of the warland is a little bit irrelevant. But in fact, the difference is fundamental. The rights imposed between inland and warland are a clear fault line in Anglo-Saxon society, and we're going to talk about why that is. The first difference is the type of work required to their lord between those on inland and those on warland. Let us take the agricultural commitment of the yeniat and the cotsetlan. Before I do, though, let me remind you of some of the duties of the yibor, their equivalent on inland, that we heard of last week, so we can compare and contrast together. Should we do that? Okay. Here's the yibor. He must work for 2 days in each week, doing such work as he is directed to throughout the year, and to work for 3 days each week during the harvest and for 3 days each week from Candlemas to Easter. That, by the way, was just the start of what the yibor had to do, but I didn't want to go overboard with you. Meanwhile, then, the cotsetlan, or the cottager of the warland on the Bath estate, was required to labour for his lord each Monday throughout the year, or for 3 days each week throughout the harvest. It is interesting that the day required for the work is specified. The yibor just had to do what he was told when he was told. On Tuesday, the cottager can tell his lord to go and jump in a lake. The yibor cannot. But the 3 days each week throughout the harvest is the most interesting. So in this obligation, you can trace the communal life of the ancient shear. People working together at heavy times of year to get the hard work done on time. The collaboration the community needed to survive and to thrive. The ploughing, bringing in the harvest. This kind of obligation was often called boon work. The word boon has an old English root, which is ben, or prayer, something prayed for, requested, needed. The sense is of the family that owns the land going round to their neighbours and asking them to come together and help bring their harvest in return for which he will feed them and provide them with ale while they do it. There is a sense of equality, of reciprocity. Now, in later centuries, the more powerful lords and landowners put pressure on their peasantry, and these dues do begin to look more compulsory. And indeed, in practice, given the inequalities in power, the peasant really doesn't feel able to refuse. But, well, behind it all, there is still a quid pro quo, a favour done in return for something. There is still a sense of neighbourliness, the community together of custom. Boon work is part of the reciprocal nature of the Anglo-Saxon custom. An action, asking for help at a key time of year, has an appropriate response, boon work. As part of the deal, the family asking for the help would provide food and drink on the days worked. One more thing. A critical difference between boon work and the sort of work that you boarded on the inland estate is that the chil knew exactly when it would be delivered and to what extent. The yibor, on the other hand, did not. The demands on them had aspects of the same status as Bracton, the legal expert, would give an unfree serf or villein in the 13th century. That was someone who doesn't know in the evening what work he will have to do in the morning, and is bound to do whatever he is bid. Some yeniats did horsework in the sense of droving or carting. Here was work to support the economic health of the estate, taking salt, lead, cattle, hides and wool to market on its wider behalf. Again, all of this type of work is honourable, and it's very related to the origin of all these dues, to the fiorum owed to the king or lord, a tribute based on the idea of hospitality and neighbourliness and the needs of the wider community. Everyone needed salt. Again, honourable work. So, when the king came to visit the shire and stay on the estate, the warland inhabitants would be those required to turn out and help the hunt or carry out riding duties and messenger duties. And indeed, they would do that willingly, because to be seen at the side of their lord added to their reputation, rank and status. And in return for their service, they got to stand by their lord and the chance to raise issues of their and local concerns with the great lord or lady. The other key difference between the duties of the yibor of the inland and the yeniat of the warland is the idea of public service. The inland yibor owed work in return for livelihood to the lord. Their status did not require or indeed allow them to carry out any public service for the state at all. All the service they owed was part of a contract with their lord. The proud warlander, the yeniat, thane, cotsetlan, all owed public service. Military, bridge and fortification work, as we said, irrespective of the dues they owed to their lord. The requirement for military service would, of course, include the requirement to bear arms. That is, of course, a slightly daft statement, isn't it? I mean, duh, no, really. But in my defence, I make this super obvious statement because the relationship between personal freedom and arms bearing is absolutely fundamental. So if we see a man with a spear, we're looking at a freeman. And if we see a man being berated for carrying a spear, we're probably looking at a serf or unfree man. Which brings us all kicking and screaming to the famous third. Although there is much debate about the nature of the third, it was essentially the militia of the Anglo-Saxon community, called out by the ealdorman of the shire when danger threatened. A section in Domesday explains that, "When the king goes against his enemy, each man was summoned and must serve who was so free that he has his sake and soak and can go with his land wherever he wishes." Sake and soak are another pair of words for a freeman's right. The third, then, is associated with freedom, with free men and with warland. People called out for waru, defence. So, the three kinds of public service for free families, military, fortifications, bridge repair. I've also mentioned that the inhabitants of warland were required to pay tax to the king, or geld, as it was called, and that this suggested they were free. The association between the king's taxation and freedom went way back and would last a long time, well beyond the Norman conquest. So, in 12th century Glastonbury, for example, a proud peasant defended his freedoms by saying, "In the old days, his father held this geldable yard land freely by the king's taxation." His point was that his freedom was all bound up with the fact that his land was geldable, therefore it was warland, and the taxation meant he was free, had a direct relationship with the king. Anglo-Saxon society required more public participation than just these three public services and tax, though. There was one other major one we should turn to now, the responsibility of every citizen to maintain public order. Much justice under feudal jurisdictions on the continent were delivered through manorial courts, private courts where the lord of the manor administered justice to his tenants and serfs. The people to whom he would administer said justice, much of what it might impinge on his own rights, were both free and unfree, but only the free had access to royal justice. Anglo-Saxon England was very different. The courts were all public courts, not private ones like manorial courts. They were administered on behalf of the king, presided over by the ealdormen or their officials, through the shire and then later through administrative areas like hundreds and counties. The justice delivered was available to all. Even the churl had a weregild. They were law-worthy. They could appeal to the law's protection and judgment, but they also had a responsibility to maintain and sustain the law and its delivery. The law-worthy churl was required to travel to the public courts. In our area of Bensonshire, that meant all turning up at Churlworth's Tree when required, which was also where the local moot and assembly would meet. It was a duty and a right of all freemen, and the laws specifically stated they were required of every person who wishes to be held worthy of his weregild. They would go as part of their tithing. Now, the custom of the tithing is a delightful way to understand the public nature of the Anglo-Saxon polity. All free males over 12 were to be in a tithing of 10 people, presided over by one of their own as the tithing man. Their obligations ignored secular or religious boundaries. They must present crimes for the court to consider. They must answer queries from the state and the justices to make arrangements for the collection of alms and observance of fasts as well. Joining the tithing was an important rite of passage into adult society. The tithing man was responsible for making sure everyone in his tithing fulfilled their responsibilities properly, and as you can imagine, that brought considerable status, as well, possibly, as being something of a pain in the bum. They took part in the deliberations of the assemblies, the churl that is, the folk moot, in which customs and collective memory were very important in making decisions. So they were not exactly judges, but there is a casual assumption that knowledge of the law is everyone's responsibility personally, and indeed is possible for everyone. The idea of a law so complex that it is the preserve simply of legal experts is way, way into the future. Participation, as I say, was integral to Anglo-Saxon justice, since, of course, there was no police force. So every dispute or settlement was essentially confirmed by oath, by the witnesses and oath helpers who swore as to the credit and trustworthiness of the parties involved, or to stand as surety for the accused or indeed convicted. While we're on it, this emphasises that a good standing and reputation was a very important part of being a good and effective member of society. So much was informal, based on personal understanding. There are no or few written contracts to refer to. Your reputation depended on many things, of course, the status of your lord, your wealth, the way you carried and conducted yourself, your delivery of public obligations. All of this came together into your reputation, your weorda, your worth, which was formed by people who knew you personally. There is no online influencing here. There are no credit rating agencies, blah, and indeed, blah. The people who know you form your public relationship. Everything is very personal. So if your reputation was strong, life was much better for you. Life was much easier. Many activities and roles central to society could be more easily achieved. In making major purchases at cattle market, people would trust that you could pay. In gaining credit, people would trust that they would be repaid. Your word as a witness was better valued in court. Your influence with your lord and your advice was higher. A witness in the Anglo-Saxon justice system, by the way, had a much wider role than the current meaning as an observer. Back then, a witness was someone who had personal knowledge of the situation or event, someone who could help form the solution. With such a central role, then, Personal reputation was also a massive thing as to whether or not your information and view was trusted or rather discounted. Anglo-Saxon England has its structure of king, ealdmen, thanes, its hierarchy and elites. But it is deeply participatory all the way down the social ladder. It is based on a reciprocal principle. Your status brought you the responsibility to deliver public obligations. Those obligations, in turn, brought status. There we go then. We have an early and mid Anglo-Saxon world where land had a major impact on your status. If you continued to hold your land as warland, you participated in a state to which you owed public obligations. The warland churls were part of a class which contained both relatively large landowners and small-scale subsistence farmers. The warland peasant owned their land as of their own right. They paid their public geld. They attended public courts, served in the ferd, or helped pay for a soldier to go from their area, contributed to bridge and fortification work. They were obliged to turn up at the estate centre to do occasional harvesting and ploughing work, but they did that from an enduring sense of being good neighbours, boon work, as good members of the community at a defined time of year. They were not simply at the whim of the thane. In the later Anglo-Saxon state, though, the pressures that led to the growth of unfree inland workers were growing stronger and broadening and deepening. The resulting changes would have a fundamental impact not just on society and individual lives, but on the very fabric and landscape of England, in a way that you can still see every time you step out of the door in the countryside. They will lead to the creation of smaller estates and secular resident lords. It will lead to a reorganisation of a large part of the English lowland landscape and how it was organised. And from it will come one of the glories of the English countryside, the nucleated English village. We'll talk about the start of that process next time and hear about the rise of the thane and the changes in the economy. Do remember then to look up the resources at thehistoryofengland.co.uk in the Anglo-Saxon England podcast section. They are generally helpful, though there are only a couple of slides specifically on this episode, slides 21 and 22. Do let me know what you think of the Land, Lordship and People series on the website if you wish, or on Apple Podcast or on the Facebook group. Either way. I hope you're enjoying it. Thanks again very much for listening. Good luck and have a great week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.